Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. In this audio, we will examine Numbers chapter 6, verses 1 through 27. We'll talk about the Nazarite vow. And at the very end of the chapter, we will look at the famous Aaronic blessing, or the priestly blessing. Our context is this. In Numbers 5, we looked at the law of people who were unclean and thus made the camp Levitically unclean. Then we looked at restitution and the necessity thereof. And then we looked at the famous trial by ordeal for adultery. So, starting in Numbers 6, 1 through 4, we read this. Again, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when a man or a woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazarite, to dedicate himself to the Lord, he shall abstain from wine and strong drink. He shall drink no vinegar, whether made from wine or strong drink, nor shall he drink any grape juice, nor eat fresh or dried grapes. All the days of his separation he shall not eat anything that is produced by the grapevine, from the seeds even to the skin." Now notice first of all that in verse 2 it says when a man or a woman makes a special vow. So a woman could take this Nazarite vow. And you notice that the New American Standard Version uses the male pronoun here. When a man or a woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazarite, to dedicate himself to the Lord. Oh, such sexism. Isn't that awful? They didn't even say to him or herself. Well, anyway, the woman could make a special vow. Now, these vows here are assumed to be of people who are legally emancipated. Now, there were some women who were not legally emancipated, or minors too, for that matter. But, for example, if a woman was married, there were special rules in chapter 30 of Numbers that applied to her. Or if she was unmarried and still in her father's house, there were rules that applied to her. We read this in Numbers 30, verses 3 through 5. Also, if a woman makes a vow to the Lord and binds herself by an obligation in her father's house in her youth, and her father hears her vow and her obligation by which she has bound herself, and her father says nothing to her, then all her vows shall stand, and every obligation which she has bound herself shall stand. But if her father should forbid her on the day he hears of it, none of her vows or her obligations by which she has bound herself shall stand, and the Lord will forgive her because her father has forbidden her. Now the idea here is that the father will protect his daughter if she goes out and makes a vow to some playboy schmuck and says, "Oh, I love you. I'll plight my troth to you. I'll marry you. I vow it." And the father hears that and he says, no, you don't. The vow is hereby annulled. He could do that. Or if the father listens to it and says, "Boy, I'd be glad to get rid of my daughter. She's driving me crazy. And this guy looks like he's all right." And if he's quiet, then the woman is bound by her vow. That's in the case of a single woman, unmarried, in the house of a father. Numbers 30, verses 6 through 8. The next three verses talk about a married woman who makes a vow. Verse 6. "However, she should marry while under her vows, or the rash statement of her lips by which she has bound herself, and her husband hears of it and says nothing to her on the day he hears of it." He's got one day to complain. "Then her vow shall stand, and her obligations by which she has bound herself shall stand. But if on the day her husband hears of it, he forbids her, then he shall annul her vow which she is under, and the rash statement of her lips by which she has bound herself, and the Lord will forgive her." Forgive her of keeping the vow. So, let's say, for example, wife is in the living room with her husband, and she says, "I vow to God that I'm going to take a Nazarite vow, and I'm not going to drink wine or cut my hair for the next 10 years. Whew, long time. And the husband says, oh no, you're not going to do that. Then the vow goes away. But if the woman is legally emancipated, if she's not married and she's not in the house of her father, she can make this vow too. Well, what is the now vow of a Nazarite? Well, the word Nazarite means a separated one. Notice that the word separated is right there in verse 4, all the days of his separation. That's what Nazarite means. It means, quote, a separated one, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. The word Nazarite comes from the Hebrew word for separate. And if you think about it, this is the basic idea for holiness. Remember in the book of Leviticus, the whole book was about holiness. And the definition of holiness, very simple definition, separated from the world and dedicated to God. So a Nazarite, in his person, makes himself separate from the world and dedicated to God. Now, as John Gill says, there were several varieties of a Nazarite vow. A Nazarite could, number one, be appointed by God, for example, Samson. A Nazarite vow, for example, number 2, could be devoted to God by his parents, for example, Samuel. Or option number 3, a Nazarite could become a Nazarite on his own motion. And that's the type that is mainly talked about here in these verses, one who chooses to become a Nazarite himself. Now, verse 2 says, the Nazarite shall dedicate himself to the Lord. Now, it doesn't say how long. That's because the person making the Nazarite vow could choose how long. It could be for a period of time. The NIV Study Bible says that sometimes even for life. Let's look at Judges 13:5. This is referring to Samson. For behold, you shall conceive and give birth to a son. This is Samson's mother, of course. And no razor shall come upon Samson's head. For the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb. That means for his whole life. And he shall begin to deliver Israel. Now here's another verse referring to Samson, Judges 16:17. So he, Samson, told her, Delilah, all that was in his heart and said to her, a razor has never come on my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. His whole life. That's kind of a long one. Most of the time it's for a restricted term, a definite term, not your whole life. NIV Study Bible makes a comment about this. Usually more attention is given to the negative prohibitions applicable to Nazarites, but not so much attention is given to the fact that a Nazarite positively devoted himself to the Lord. He dedicated himself to the Lord. The not eating, not drinking wine, and not cutting your hair, those were just outward symbols of that to show that you dedicated yourself to the Lord. But the important thing to remember, this is a vow of dedication, not an AA vow to keep from drinking liquor. It was not a vow to lose weight. It was not a vow of personal discipline, but it was a vow showing total devotion to God. Now, this is a little off the subject, but I found a verse in Lamentations 4, verse 7, that the King James uses to translate princes as Nazarites. Her consecrated ones, talking about Jerusalem, her consecrated one, and the KJV has Nazarites. I'm reading from the New American Standard. Her consecrated ones, her Nazarites, were purer than snow, says the King James. They were whiter than milk. They were more ruddy in body than corals. Their polishing was like lapis lazuli. And I thought about this. I don't believe the King James is right about this. I think NIV has princes. Her princes were purer than snow. NASB has for consecrated ones. I don't think it's necessarily referring to Nazarites. But it's interesting that these princes of Israel are very Americanized. They were whiter than milk. That's white. They were ruddy in body. That's red. And their polishing was like lapis lazuli. That's blue. They were red, white, and blue. Now, I would be careful about interpreting the verse that way. I just thought it was kind of interesting. All right, now, verse 3 says that these Nazarites are not to drink any wine and no strong drink either. Well, as an introduction to the restrictions here, we see no wine, and we can look at the three ways in which things were regulated in the Nazarites' life. This is from the NIV Study Bible. First of all, the diet of the Nazarite. Second of all, the appearance of the Nazarite. Diet means you don't drink wine. Appearance, you let your hair grow long. Associations, you don't touch anybody that's unclean. We'll see that as we go through. Now, every Israelite was regulated in these areas anyway, as we know, according to the NIV Study Bible, but the regulations were heightened for the Nazarite, as we'll see. Now, why the prohibition against drinking wine? Here's what Jameson Fawcett Brown says. The use of wine tended to inflame the passion, intoxicate the brain, and create a taste for luxurious indulgence. You know, wine means you're having a party, you're having a good time, you're feeling good. But a Nazarite vow is more like a fast. Nothing wrong with eating food, but not if you're trying to fast to show your mourning or your separation unto God. Now, not only was it forbidden to the Nazarite to drink wine, but he could also not drink strong drink. Well, what's strong drink? According to Gill, strong drink, as opposed to wine, strong drink is fermented alcoholic drinks from fruit and grains other than grapes. For example, pomegranates, dates, barley, apples, pears, or you can make alcohol out of any of those things. I remember there was an alcoholic drink in China called Baijiu, which is literally translated white alcohol. And Baijiu could be made from barley, wheat, dates, any vegetable, anything. And it was made from all kinds of things. You never knew exactly what it was. You just knew that it would be better not to drink it because this stuff tastes so awful. I was constantly being importuned to take that nasty stuff to show conviviality and fellowship with the foreigner. I refused. I had one little sip one time. I said, nope, that's it. Not going to take that stuff. But at any rate, no wine, no strong drink. Here's what Jameson Fawcett Brown said about the prohibition against strong drink. Quote, it was used to designate a class of persons who, under the impulse of extraordinary piety and with a view to higher degrees of religious improvement, voluntarily renounced the occupations and pleasures of the world to dedicate themselves unreservedly to the divine service. These 19th century commentators, they can say things that nobody else can say. Well, not only was the Nazarite not supposed to drink wine or grape juice, or strong drink, also not vinegar. Well, what's vinegar? Vinegar is wine that's gone sour, or strong drink that's gone sour. Even today, you get an old bottle of wine, and it tastes just like vinegar when you drink it. It's awful. What's the purpose of this? This is my idea. It's a kind of a hedge. If you don't drink vinegar, well, that's because vinegar, I mean, what's that? How's that going to hurt anything? Well, maybe you're drinking vinegar that used to be just about 5 minutes ago used to be strong drink. So this is kind of a hedge. If you don't drink vinegar, you're not going to be eating strong drink. And this prohibition also in verse 3, you're not supposed to drink grape juice. You're not supposed to eat grapes. You're not supposed to eat the seeds of the skin. That's all the idea is. You get way away from wine. You're not going to be enjoying anything during this time of restraint on your pleasures. We go now to number 6, verse 5. All the days of his vow of separation, no razor shall pass over his head. He shall be holy until the days are fulfilled for which he separated himself to the Lord. He shall let the locks of hair on his head grow long. Now, until the days are fulfilled, that just depends on how long the vow is. The Nazarite got to choose. Could be 3 days, could be 3 months. Now, why the prohibition to cut his hair? Well, here are three options to answer that question. Option number one. Cutting one's hair is a recognized sign of cleanliness, and so then letting one's hair grow long would be a recognized sign of uncleanness, according to the law. Let's read Leviticus 14, 8 through 9. The one to be cleansed from a skin disease shall then wash his clothes and shave off all his hair and bathe in water and be clean. It shall be on the seventh day that he shall shave off all his hair. He shall shave his head and his beard and his eyebrows, even all his hair. Get rid of every hair so he looks like a cue ball, and he'll be clean. So that's how a person with a skin disease was cleaned, by cutting off his hair, so the hair would be a symbol of uncleanness. So if you let your hair grow, that's the opposite. That would be, well, it would be the symbol of, if your head was bald, that would be a symbol of cleanliness. So therefore, if your hair is long, would be the opposite, a symbol of uncleanness. So I guess the idea is saying, well, and then the reason I have a little problem with that is, why would you want to say a Levite is unclean? It seems to me like he's sort of holy to me, not unclean. You mean a Levite can't offer a peace offering at the temple? I don't like that option. Let's look at option number 2. The NIV Study Bible says that the long hair would specially mark off the Nazarite to the public so that everyone could see this as a public vow. And the Nazarite vow was a public vow. There was nothing private about it. And I think that probably makes a lot of sense. John Gill has an idea that the hair is a sign of subjection to authority, quoting the famous verse in 1 Corinthians 11:5, but every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. Why? Because she shows no authority. She's not under the authority of God or her husband. And so, therefore, long hair shows authority. If you think about it, girls with long hair, don't they look submissive? They really do. Now, I've gotten myself in trouble over this. I taught 1 Corinthians 11 one time. I'll never forget it. Got all the way through the lesson. I thought I'd done a real good job of explaining that very difficult passage. And then I got to the part about how, don't you know by nature, long hair is honorable and all that kind of stuff on a woman. And then I realized that one of the women in the meeting, who I knew very well, and it just never occurred to me, her hair was shorter than mine. She was a black woman, and her hair was shorter than mine. And I said, oh my gosh, I hope I haven't offended her. And she wasn't. She was real good about it. And I remember another time when I was at seminary years ago, and there was a girl, I don't remember her name, I remember her first name was Karen, and that girl was smart. She made a 1600 on an SAT, and that's why I couldn't believe it. I never met anybody made a 1600 on the SAT. I mean, she was brilliant. And we got to talking about this verse, as you do at seminary. You talk about the hard verses. And she says, I can prove to you. And I was saying, well, long hair just looks better. By nature, long hair looks better on women. Shows submissiveness and authority and femininity and all that. And she says, it does. I said, yeah. Now, her hair was, it wasn't crew cut by any means, but it was relatively short. It was a short woman's haircut. And she says, I'll show you. I can prove it to you right now that that's not true. I said, okay. She pulls a picture out of her wallet. It's a picture of her shortly before the time we were discussing, conversing. And the picture of her was when she had long hair and it looked absolutely horrible. And her short haircut looked fine. So I laughed. I said, yeah, you got me on that one. So, but at any rate, hair in general, let's put it this way. Hair in general does show submission to authority. We read actually in verse 7 to kind of back this idea up. If we hop down here to verse 7, it says that during his Nazarite vow time, his separation to God is on his head. His separation to God is on his head. And I think what that means is that if you look at his head, you'll see he's separated to God because he got long hair on his head. That shows submission to God. So Gil might be right about that. The long hair shows submission to God. We go now to Numbers chapter 6, verses 6 through 8. All the days of his separation to the Lord, he shall not go near to a dead person. He shall not make himself unclean for his father or for his mother, for his brother or for his sister when they die, because his separation to God is on his head. In other words, his long hair is there. He's taking a Nazarite vow, so he's not going to handle the funeral of any of his family. All the days of his separation, he is holy to the Lord. And that's why I think that the long hair is not a sign of uncleanliness, because he's holy to the Lord. That's not unclean. That's holy. Holy is the opposite of unclean. Now, these restrictions on a Nazarite to keep him from handling funeral arrangements for his family are actually stricter even than for the common priest. We read in Leviticus 21, verses 1 through 3, Then the Lord said to Moses, Speak to the priest, the sons of Aaron, and say to them, No one shall defile himself for a dead person among his people, except for his relatives who are nearest to him, his mother and his father, his son and his daughter and his brother, also for his virgin sister, who has no husband. So a priest could handle the funeral arrangements of his immediate family without being unclean. Well, it says for them, for the virgin sister, he may defile himself. That means he can touch the dead bodies, handle the arrangements, no problem. Now, for the high priest, we read in Leviticus 21, 10 through 11, the priest who is the highest among his brothers, on whose head the anointing oil has been poured and who's been consecrated to wear the garments, shall not uncover his head nor tear his clothes, nor shall he approach any dead person, nor defile himself even for his father or his mother. So the high priest couldn't touch anybody in a funeral, and that's just the same as the Nazarite. So the Nazarite, this is a strict vow. And you know, that's pretty tough. Your father dies and you can't handle the funeral arrangements of your mother, but that's the way it was. This is a serious vow. The wife and daughter is not mentioned in these verses in Numbers 6, 6 through 8, but I think we can extrapolate to them too, because it's basically talking about immediate family members, and a wife and a daughter, that's immediate family. We go now to Numbers 6, 9 through 12. But if a man dies very suddenly beside him, and he defiles his dedicated head of hair, then he shall shave his head on the day when he becomes clean. He shall shave it on the seventh day. Then on the eighth day he shall bring two turtle doves or two young pigeons to the priest to the doorway of the tent of meeting. The priest shall offer one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering, and make atonement for him concerning his sin because of the dead person. And that same day he shall consecrate his head, and shall dedicate to the Lord his days as a Nazarite, and shall bring a male lamb, a year old, for a guilt offering. But the former days will be void, because his separation was defiled. Now, verses 9 through 12 and number 6 refer to a situation that is probably not going to happen very often. A person dies next to him suddenly. I've never had that happen. I'm 69 years old. I hope it never does happen. That's kind of a strange thing. But if it does, and how might it happen? Well, say somebody's sick, and you are tending to the sick person, all of a sudden they breathe the last, oh my goodness, the person's died, and here I was trying to give them medicine, and now I've defiled myself by touching a dead body. Maybe the person is murdered or killed while you're standing next to him, and somebody kills him. We can speculate, but the point is, if it happens, your Nazarite vow is kaputsky, because you are now unclean. You are defiled, as the NASB puts it. The Nazarite has defiled his dedicated head of hair, which is a kind of a roundabout way of saying that he himself is defiled. His hair is defiled, so he's defiled. His hair was dedicated to God, but now, doggone it, it's involved in death. Now, I don't believe that that means that the dead person actually touches the hair. I mean, the dead person could just touch the body. Well, the Nazarite could touch the dead person's body somehow, and that would defile his dedicated hair, not by directly touching it, but just because with his hands or in a normal way, the Nazarite touched the dead body. Well, anyway, when that happens, we see in verse 9 that the Nazarite shall shave his head on the day when he becomes clean. Now, what that means is on the seventh day he shaves his head. So he's unclean. This is the typical law for unclean people. You're unclean for 7 days, and then you shave your head on the seventh day to show that you're clean. So basically what this says is if a Nazarite touches a dead person, that puts an end to the Nazarite vow he was under, as John Gill says, and then he has to start all over again and make a new Nazarite vow. He's unclean for 7 days, just like everybody is. Numbers 19:11, the one who touches the corpse of any person shall be unclean for 7 days, not just Nazarites, but anybody. And it says the one who touches the corpse. I just think that's also referring to the Nazarite who touches the corpse. It means that his dedicated hair of head touches the corpse. The Nazarite touches the corpse. 7 is the number of divine perfection and completion, which means that after you've gone through that divinely perfect cleansing period, you are completely and perfectly and maturely clean after 7 days. Let me make one other point here. If a man dies very suddenly, this would indicate that it was an event beyond the Nazarite's control. He can't help it if the sick person dies on him all of a sudden or somebody murders somebody next to him. But it doesn't matter. The Nazarite vow is so strict that even if the Nazarite is completely innocent in getting himself defiled, he's still got to end his vow and go through the cleansing ritual for 7 days. At the end of the 7 days, he offers 2 turtle doves and 2 young pigeons. One is for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering. When it says, or young pigeons, he got to choose. You could either have 2 turtle doves or you could bring 2 young pigeons. And one of those, if you brought 2 turtle doves, one was for a sin offering, one was for a burnt offering. If you bought 2 young pigeons, then one of the pigeons was for a sin offering and the other was for a burnt offering. And of course, sin offerings are to atone for sin, cover sin that was done against God. Burnt offering is to dedicate yourself wholly to God. That's the common symbolism of those 2 types of offerings. So that's 2 offerings, sin and burnt. And down in verse 12, we see also the defiled Nazarite has to bring a guilt offering, a male lamb a year old for a guilt offering. Male lamb is a ram. Guilt offerings were always rams, as we saw in the book of Leviticus. But the former days will be void because the separation was defiled. In other words, his time of his Nazarite vow is kaputsky. It's over with. He's got to start all over again. Now think about this. Let's say he had a vow. He made a vow for 365 days, for a year. He's on day 364. He's just got to make it to Lamar and he ends up touching some dead person through no fault of his own. He's lost all those 364 days, and he's got to start all over. Now, the next question is, does he have to start over? Well, a vow's a vow. I guess he would. He needs to finish his vow. He didn't finish it. So, he would have to start all over again and do another Nazarite vow for 365 days. So, all of this shows that a Nazarite's got to be very, very careful, especially near the end of his term of the vow, to not do something that's going to defile him, because he'll have to go back and do the vow all over again. And the reason I think that he has to do it all over again, he can't just optionally just say, I quit, I'm finished with this vow, because it says here in verse 11, and that same day, in other words, the same day that he's offered the sin offering and the burnt offering after his head's been shaved clean, he's been cleansed, and that same day he shall consecrate his head and shall dedicate to the Lord his days as a Nazarite. In other words, I'm going to let my hair grow again. I'm dedicating to you, Lord, the same term, my days as a Nazarite. It's yours again. The 2 turtle doves are 2 young pigeons that were offered as a sin offering and a burnt offering. Those were the same 2 offerings that were given by women who were being purified after their childbirth. Leviticus 12:8, but if she cannot afford a lamb, then she shall take 2 turtle doves or 2 young pigeons. The one for a burnt offering and the one for a sin offering. Same thing. Or people with running fluids, as Gill puts it, discharges. Leviticus 15:14, then on the 8th day, this is after they've been cleansed from those discharges, on the 8th day he shall take for himself 2 turtle doves or 2 young pigeons. Same idea. So the sin offering takes care of the pollution that occurs because of the death, and the burnt offering gives thanks for God for relieving the pollution. Notice how in verse 11 it was on the same day. The Nazarite vow started on exactly the same day as the old one. was prematurely cut short. Now, I said without comment or without question that the days mentioned in verse 12, he shall dedicate the Lord his days as a Nazarite, was probably the same term as the previous vow. I think it was. John Gill says it was, but it doesn't actually say that. So perhaps not. So here we have, at the end of an unfortunate defilement of the Nazarite, three offerings that have to be given. Sin offering, burnt offering, and a guilt offering. And notice, by the way, guilt offering. Usually we think guilt offering, somebody harms somebody else and they have to make restitution plus 20%. Not here. There's no restitution. Just a guilt offering. And I think the idea of all three sacrifices having to be offered sort of accentuates the fact that this is a serious, serious vow. We go now to Numbers 6, verses 13 through 15. Now this is the law of the Nazarite when the days of his separation are fulfilled. He shall bring the offering to the doorway of the tent of meeting. He shall present his offering to the Lord, one male lamb a year old without defect for a burnt offering, and one ewe lamb a year old without defect for a sin offering, and one ram without defect for a peace offering, and a basket of unleavened cakes of fine flour mixed with oil, and unleavened wafers spread with oil, along with their grain offering and their drink offering. Now, this refers to when the Nazarite vow ends naturally. If he says, my vow is for a month, and this is the month that's gone, and it ends naturally, there's no defilement in between. We see three types of offerings that are a little bit different. Instead of sin, burnt, and guilt, it's sin, burnt, and peace offering. A little bit easier. I say a little bit more positive. I guess you can put it that way. Peace offering is a fellowship offering. Guilt offering means you did something wrong. I shouldn't say he did anything wrong because he didn't, but it's associated with something negative, death. So this is different. Now, verse 13, when it says, now this is the law of Nazarite, that could refer to what we just read. Now this, these regulations about what happened when a dead person touches a Nazarite could be the law of the Nazarite, or it could be this which follows the lamb burnt and sin offerings, not the two turtle dove lamb and sin offerings, but the two lamb burnt and sin offerings. Or it could be both for that matter. But at any rate, the Nazarite who has finished his vow shall bring his offering to the doorway of the tent of meeting. That's right there at the front door of the tabernacle. Tent of meeting, of course, is just another word for the tabernacle. Right there at the doorway where you have the bronze laver off a little bit to one side, and then directly in front of the doorway you have the bronze altar burnt offering. That's where you bring it. And this means that the ending of the vow was very, very public, because the Nazarite vow was a public vow. Now, all of these offerings that the Nazarite had to bring, 1 year old male lamb and 1 year old ewe lamb and one adult ram. It's expensive. And not to mention the grain offerings and the drink offerings. The NIV Study Bible says these required offerings were extensive, expensive, and expressive of total commitment. In other words, the Nazarite vow was real serious. You didn't take it lightly. Now, a male lamb, that's a typical offering for a burnt offering. Lamb, Leviticus 1:10, but if his offering is from the flock, it shall be a male without defect. The ewe lamb is for a sin offering, and that was a typical sin offering for the common man. The sin offerings for the common man were female, Leviticus 4:32, but if he brings a lamb as his offering for a sin offering, he shall bring it a female without defect. So the offerings were the same as the Levitical laws here. Now, the peace offering sacrifice could be any animal, but here there's a specific animal required, a ram, which is a male lamb. And also, you got your unleavened cakes. Remember, you got fine flour mixed with oil. You bring it to the priest, and then the priest puts a memorial portion on the altar. It burns up, goes to God. So God, we're giving you the first of our bread here. Now we're going to enjoy eating what's left. And so they cooked it in one of three ways. In an oven, which is kind of a hole in the ground lined with pottery. Or in a pan, kind of like deep dish pizza. Or in a griddle, flat piece of iron. And so it produced three different kind of cakes. They put oil on top. It sounds so good to eat. I even think I'm on a diet now where I can't eat bread. I shouldn't even be talking about it. But doesn't that sound good? So anyway, the priest would eat all that. The grain offered is a symbol of God's munificence, his blessing to his people. He gives them food to eat. The grain offering is the grain that was presented to the altar first, mixed with oil, and then the priest would take a piece of it, put it on the altar, and the rest of it was cooked. And the drink offering was always offered with a grain offering. I'm pretty sure it's always, which was just, I think it was a hen, which I think is a quart, if I remember correctly. Don't take my word for that. These measurements I sometimes forget. But the point is the hen of wine was poured out on the altar, burnt, pshht, off into the smoke it goes. Wine, of course, is a symbol of joy and peace and happiness and all that. It's ironic. The Nazarite can't drink wine during the whole time of his vow, but by golly, he's got to put wine on there to give it to God. It's a little bit ironic. We go down to number 6, verses 16 through 18. Then the priest shall present them before the Lord. Now, the them there is these offerings. Holman Christian Study Bible actually translates it that way and says these. So the priest shall present these before the Lord and shall offer his sin offering and his burnt offering. Shall offer the Nazarite's sin offering and burnt offering, which, of course, a female lamb and a male lamb. He shall also offer the ram for a sacrifice of peace offerings to the Lord. Together with the basket of unleavened cakes, the priest shall likewise offer its grain offering and its drink offering. The Nazarite shall then shave his dedicated head of hair at the doorway of the tent of meeting and take the dedicated hair of his head and put it on the fire, which is under the sacrifice of peace offerings. All right, so again, sin, burn, and peace, those are three of the major offerings. Now in verse 18, we see that the Nazarite is going to burn his hair up on the fire. Let's assume that fire is the bronze altar just for right now. What's the symbolism of this? Well, it means that since the Nazarite was wholly devoted to the Lord, the thing which showed he was wholly devoted to the Lord is burn up on the altar and devoted to the Lord. Burn up, comes up, it goes up in smoke up into heaven where God lives. Now, of course, it's illegal to burn human flesh on the altar, so the Nazarite can't put himself on the altar, but he can put his hair instead, as Adam Clark says. So the symbolism is pretty neat there. Now, there is a question, is exactly where this hair was burned. I just said assume the bronze altar. Actually, the commentators split on that. It says in verse 18 that the hair is to be put on the fire, which is under the sacrifice of peace offerings. Well, the problem with that is that peace offerings were cooked in two different places. The fat was put on the altar and burned up and went to God. And then the breast, the right foreleg, and just the regular flesh of the animal was cooked in the courtyard, boiled. Some translations say I like cooked better because it's roasted, tastes better. And then the priest would eat it with the family, with the offeror. So that would take a fire to cook the lamb in the courtyard. So which fire is it? Well, I have found three commentators, Gill, Benson, and Poole, who say that the fire was under the pot where the peace offerings were being boiled or cooked in the courtyard. But on the other hand, I found three commentators that say it was on the fire on the bronze altar. Kylan Delitzsch, Adam Clark, and the Pulpit Commentary. That's where the fat of the peace offering was burned on the altar. Well, I guess a split 3-3, that's a pretty close question. I tend to think it's the altar myself. One argument against it being the altar is that the hair is not really a sacrifice. It's not like an animal sacrifice. But on the other hand, it is like a sacrifice because you're sacrificing your hair. So I don't know. We'll leave that one as a close call for you to decide. I report it, you decide it. By the way, when it says the hair will be put on the fire, which is under the sacrifice of peace offerings, the fire is under the peace offerings, but you could burn the hair right next to the fat if it was on the altar, or you could put it in the same pot with the lamb, or you could put it on the fire by the side of the pot if it's the fire in the courtyard that's being referred to here, so that's not really a problem. That under word is not a problem. We go down to number 6, 19 through 20. The priest shall take the ram's shoulder when it has been boiled, and one unleavened cake out of the basket, and one unleavened wafer, and shall put them on the hands of the Nazarite after he has shaved his dedicated hair. Then the priest shall wave them for a wave offering before the Lord. It is holy for the priest, together with the breast offered by waving and the thigh offered by lifting up, and afterward the Nazarite may drink wine. Praise the Lord. Now, first of all, let's talk about the cakes. It says the cake out of the basket. What they would do is they would offer the grain mixed with oil to the priest, and then he would give the rest of the grain back to one of the officiating Levites, and then they would cook it in the courtyard, and they put it in a basket. And they would cook it one of three ways, in the oven, in the pan, or on the griddle. They'd spread oil on it and put it in a basket so they could eat it. And so one unleavened cake was taken out of the basket. So that's part of this Nazarite wave offering that he's going to offer here. Now, it says, the priest shall take the ram shoulder in verse 19. Now, that can be a little bit confusing because in a peace offering, this is the peace offering ram that we're talking about here, a peace offering, the right shoulder went to the officiating priest. But now this is a shoulder of the lamb that the Nazarite is going to wave. So it belongs to the Nazarite. So this is going to be the left shoulder, as John Gill, Kyle and Dedich, and Benson commentaries all say. We'll leave the right shoulder to the officiating priest, at least in the normal peace offering. That's where it would go. So the Nazarite stands out there with his hands upfolded, upturned, and then the ram shoulder was put on his hand. The left shoulder was put on his hands, and then the cake and the wafer, the unleavened cake, the unleavened wafer with oil spread on it was put on top of the ram shoulder. And then in verse 20, the priest waves these two things. And what the priest would do is put his hands under the Nazarite's hands and then move both sets of hands, his hands and the Nazarite's hands, left, right, front, back. Wave it. Now, verse 20 says that not only shall the bread and the shoulder be waved, but also the breast shall be waved. Now, we got to be careful here, too, because normally a breast of a peace offering went to the priest in general, not just to the officiating priest, but to all the priests. But here, in this case of the Nazarite fulfilling his vow, the breast belongs to the Nazarite, and he offers it by waving. Now, it doesn't say whether he's waved at the same time as the shoulder and the bread. Perhaps it was done at a different time. I'd imagine it's pretty heavy if you put leg, breast, and bread all at the same time on the Nazarite's hands. So I'm assuming this is a separate waving, not only the breast, but also the thigh offered by lifting up. Now, lifting up means heave. That's a heave offering, as the old-fashioned or the New American Standard translates it that way. Now, what is that thigh that's offered by lifting up? Is that the same left ram shoulder that we already talked about? Well, no, because that was waved, not heaved. Verse 19, remember? The priest shall wave them referring to the left ram shoulder as well as the bread. So that's already been waved, but now, and we have the breast waved, but now the thigh offered is the thigh offered by lifting up, which is heaved, so that must be the right thigh. Kyle and Dedich agrees with me on that. They say this is the right shoulder, which belonged to the officiating priest normally. And so the fact that both the left and the right legs were offered up shows fellowship at a higher degree than your normal peace offering. Now, the scripture is silent here as to what was done with that, the two legs and the breast of the peace offering, as well as the rest of the flesh of the peace offering. But I will assume, just like with most peace offerings, the priest ate the meat along with the offeror, along with the Nazarite. And so they had nice fellowship. All right, we're finished. Well, let's read verse 21. This is the law of the Nazarite who vows his offering to the Lord according to his separation, in addition to what else he can afford according to his vow which he takes, so he shall do according to the law of his separation. And I emphasize separation because that's what Nazarite means. This is the law. That's probably referring to all those previous verses I read that has to do with the Nazarites. In addition to what else he can afford. In other words, in addition to the above-mentioned offerings which are prescribed by law, the sin offering, the burnt offering, and the peace offering. But he could also bring other voluntary offerings. Usually voluntary free will offerings were considered peace offerings too, but he could do that if he wanted to, as John Gill says. Now, let me go back to this. This is the law of the Nazarite. This summary statement serves two functions according to the NIV Study Bible. One, it signals the end of a section. Yes, because our next verse is going to talk about the Aaronic blessing. So it signals the end of a section. It also solemnizes the contents of the section. This is it, boys. This is it. This is the law. This is serious business. I think the NIV Study Bible is probably right about that. All right, we go now to verses 6, 22 through 27. We'll finish up this chapter. We're turning now to the Aaronic blessing. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and to his sons, saying, thus you shall bless the sons of Israel. You shall say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance on you and give you peace. So they shall invoke my name on the sons of Israel, and I then will bless them. Now, the NIV Study Bible calls this the Aaronic benediction because the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to Aaron and to his sons. It's not Aaron's benediction, it's Aaron and his sons. In other words, this is the priestly blessing, and the NIV heading actually calls it the priestly blessing. So we'll call it the priestly blessing. You are to bless the sons of Israel with this blessing. What does blessing mean? Well, first of all, the word blessing is ambiguous because if God blesses us, then he gives us something good. If we bless God, we praise him. So the word right there means something different depending on which way the blessing is going, from God to us or from us to God. But also, if we bless, not bless God, but we bless other people horizontally, then what we're doing is we're asking God's goodness, God to give good things and do great things for the other person. Now, there's an interesting verse in Deuteronomy 10:8 that talks about the duty of the priest, or at least the duty of the Levites, to bless the Israelites. Deuteronomy 10:8, at that time the Lord set apart the tribe of Levi to carry the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, to stand before the Lord to serve him and to bless in his name until this day. This seems to include the Levites in with the Aaronic priest. To me, it seems like it. At this time, the Lord set apart the tribe of Levi. That's the whole tribe of Levi, not just Aaron and his sons. And what are they set apart to do? Well, to carry the ark. We know about that. We looked at that in the last chapter. To carry the ark and to stand before the Lord to serve him. Yeah, they've got to kill all the animals and all that. And to bless in his name. So it was a duty of the Levites to bless the people. Now, that verse is not noted very often. At least I've never heard anybody mention it. Here's what John Gill says they did. Quote, standing upon an eminence, lifting up their hands on high, spreading out their fingers, and raising their voices, and pronouncing the blessing in the Hebrew language, in the name of Jehovah, with their face towards the people. Well, I imagine the Aaronic priest did that. Apparently the Levites could help them. Jameson Fawcett Brown says this, quote, says that all of this refers to, quote, the solemn benediction which God appointed for dismissing the people at the close of the daily service. So it was more of a ritualistic, liturgical type thing. I wouldn't be surprised at that, even though I'm not a liturgical person. I wouldn't be surprised if they did that kind of thing. I know this, every Sunday I go to church, one of the pastors of the church says this Aaronic blessing, word for word. I don't know. After a while, it gets to be kind of trite to me, but you know, I'm not going to get into liturgy versus low church. That's on my theological do list for later. Well, now let's look at this Aaronic blessing. This is from the NIV Study Bible Notes. Let's look at the structure. Each of the three verses involved has two parts. For example, verse 24 says, bless you and keep you. There's your two parts, bless and keep. Verse 25, his face shine on you and let him be gracious to you. So his face shines on you and you're gracious, and he's gracious to you. That's two parts in verse 25. And then in verse 26, the Lord lift up his countenance, number one, and give you peace, number two. So there's six parts of this blessing. Pretty good blessing. Each of the three verses is progressively longer. I don't know why this matters, but verse 24 has three Hebrew words. Verse 25 has five Hebrew words. Verse 26 has seven Hebrew words. It just amazes me how these scholars get into this literary stuff. Frankly, I could care less how many words are in each verse, but I thought I'd mention it to you. Now, another interesting thing about these three verses is that the name Yahweh is in there. The Lord, that's Yahweh. Capital L-O-R-D, capitalized in the translations. The Lord bless you. Verse 25, the Lord make his face shine on you. And verse 26, the Lord lift up his countenance on you and give you peace. So they shall invoke my name. So the Aaron, the priest, shall invoke my name. What's God's name? Yahweh. On the sons of Israel, and I will bless them. And that's why it's a terrible thing to take God's name in vain. If you want to say Yahweh, or God bless you, God bless you, that's serious business. Don't you say God, gazoon tight, you sneeze, God bless you. That really is taking the Lord's name sort of rashly, sort of lightly, sort of in a profane way. No, man, this is a serious blessing here. I mean, I pray this a lot for my friends and loved ones. God, please, Lord, let good things happen to them. Bless them. Relieve them of their difficulties. Let them get on top because life is so darn hard. Everything is always going wrong. Family problems, mental health problems, physical health problems, financial health problems, relationship problems. God bless them. Shine your face on me. It says the Lord make his face shine on you. What does that mean? Well, it's just like you have an algebra teacher and you look at her and her face is shining. It means she's beaming. She's got a smile because you passed your test. You think, oh, thank God, my algebra teacher's not mad at me. It's the same thing with God. His face is shining on you. Speaking anthropomorphically, at least. He's happy with you. Let him be happy with you. Now, of course, this assumes you want to get blessed. He's got to be happy with you. That doesn't mean you got to work for his happiness, but it also means you don't go out and you engage in constant habitual sin. His face is going to shine on you. There's going to be a frown on his face. So, you know, this is assuming the normal Christian life is you are living your life in the Lord. He's blessing you. His face is shining on you. He's happy with you. He's preparing for the day when he's going to glorify you in the saints, in union with the saints, to let you shine over the whole world. The Lord be gracious to you in verse 25. Grace, of course, means unmerited favor. May the Lord just show you favor that you don't deserve. Now, this is one more bit of evidence to counter the erroneous stereotype of God, which says that he does not show grace in the Old Testament. Oh, yes, he does, right here in this blessing. May the Lord be gracious to you. How many times you've heard that? You know, oh, God's a God of wrath. Only we do have Jesus in the New Testament. Well, how about Jesus in the New Testament turning over the tables of the Pharisees? And how about the 8 woes he pronounced in Matthew 23? Woe on you, you evil generation, you wicked generation. Woe on you. Yeah, that's little Jesus, meek and mild, in the New Testament. And in the Old Testament, oh, God's just a nasty old man up there throwing lightning bolts at everybody like Zeus did to the Greeks. Nonsense. Be gracious to you. It's the same God, folks, Old Testament, New Testament. He is a God of justice, and he is a God of mercy. He hates sin, and he loves his people, and he wants to free them from the burdens of their sin. Now, the last part of the blessing says that, or ask that the Lord give you peace. Well, it says the Lord lift up his countenance on you. That means may he keep looking after you and keep watching after you, which, of course, he always does. I mean, you're just kind of saying, yeah, keep doing it, God. Give you peace. Now, that is the Hebrew word shalom, which, of course, is very famous. The NIV Study Bible points out that here, peace is not just the absence of war. It's rather, quote, a positive state of rightness and well-being, unquote. In other words, you're internally at peace, you're spiritually at peace, and such peace only comes from the Lord. So it's a very good blessing here. Very, very good blessing. Ladies and gentlemen, we have finished Numbers chapter 6. We have finished talking about the Nazarite vow and the Aaronic priestly blessing. We are now prepared to go to Hebrews 7 in our next audio, verses 1 through 89. Yes, you heard that right. Verses 1 through 89, offerings at the tabernacle's consecration. This is a highly technical chapter. I've only got 6 pages of notes. The audio will probably be shorter than this one, even though it covers 89 verses. I hope you stay tuned for this exciting discussion, and I hope you enjoyed this one.